Let's read this once again, something I've covered a lot. It really struck me several years ago. I thought it helped explain the world and explain what is happening in the world. And it just struck me that I felt like God was revealing something to me, not to me only. I'm not saying that. I don't want to be vain or anything. I just felt that maybe I'd understood it differently in the past, and now I was understanding it in context of the times that we're living in. I hope that makes sense. So we begin in verse 1 of 2 Timothy 3, but know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. And we read about some of the peril that is associated with the end time in Matthew 24. What does it begin with? It begins with deception. That's a primary theme of Matthew 24. And when the disciples ask Christ, what would be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age, deception is noted more than anything else. But there's also the chaotic eruption of natural events that happen, or seemingly natural events. You know, earthquakes in different places, and famine and war and pestilence and all of that. That is chaotic of and by itself. But there's more to it than that. And natural disasters, you know, there's loss of life, there's death, there's property destruction. Mankind recovers from that. I mean, I haven't been subject to it. I mean, I don't live in Florida. I don't live in some of the areas that have had some of these horrible catastrophic events that have happened to them. And my heart and your heart goes out to all of those who do that. The Bible warns about that. I mean, we've seen what happens with these spectacular, horrible earthquakes all around the globe, right? Where buildings fall and people are crushed and all of that. That's awful. What we're talking about today is even worse than that. The human causation of events that is chaotic. It was bad enough that all these other things, famines, pestilence, you know, war and all that, and the war is man-made, of course. We're kind of bordering on the edge. But what Paul's talking about is going to be even worse, a worse causative effect on the world than even natural disasters and hurricanes and tornadoes, as horrible as all of those are. This is worse, in my opinion. So perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Break that down, and there's 18 things that Paul mentions that are a part of the perilous times of the future. I've grouped them into six similar conditions. You can go even further than I'm going today. To help understand the world around you, you have to understand that this is what Paul says would be the hallmark of the time of the end that I believe that we're living in. And I thought Mr. Elliott made a nice reference and comment to prophecy in his latest personal. And I appreciated that. Because this is not the time for what I'll mention later on, prophecy fatigue. Or people thinking of prophecy failure. Some do. Let's skip down to verse 13. It says, but evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Now, I've made the case previously, and this is what I was alluding to earlier in the challenge question. I've made the case to you in numerous messages throughout the last few years that this is key to understanding the first part of the chapter. Evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. That's the real key to understanding the first few verses of 2 Timothy, in my opinion. In studying this chapter and these verses, I believe that it has helped my understanding of Bible prophecy. And in the past few years, I've quoted this extensively to you. And my reason for repeating it today is simple. I believe it explains the conditions of the end time. Even going back 4 or 5 years, maybe even going back 10 years or so, when you begin to put the pieces together and what it is saying about what men will do and the causative effect that evil men and women will have on their environment, that is the world, it's something we ought to pay attention to, in my opinion. And especially since the time of COVID, 2020 and beyond, and all the things that have happened, as I've mentioned on several occasions, the focal point of this prophecy is not on the common man. Although the common man can have his part, it's on the leaders and the change agents of society, no matter what office or position they may have. They are people of influence. And I'm not talking about influencers, the people on social media that I'm not, you know, most of that is silly and those people have no real power. But I'm not saying all of them are silly, but I'm saying that there are some social influencers that are just influencing on things that are not really important to the things that we're speaking about today, which is Bible prophecy. Okay? So following are 6 areas that are emphasized by Paul, and there's more. There's 18 things that are mentioned here, so I'm just going to talk about 6 today. The first one is self-exaltation and narcissism of the last days. Self-exaltation and narcissism of the last days. Paul begins his warning by identifying a root problem of end-time society. Many of those that are leading the world are narcissists. In other words, they're not just they're not just the self-absorbed prom king and queen who think that the world revolves around them. They're evil people who are self-absorbed. They are thinking of no one but themselves. You know who Narcissus was in Greek mythology? Very likely. I mean, if you raise your hand for the crucible, you'll raise your hand and you'll know who Narcissus was. In Greek mythology, Narcissus was so involved with himself and so praised for his beauty that he really didn't care about anybody else, and so he was doomed to just look at his own reflection, and then finally he just was so self-absorbed he withered away. But that's not what happens to the narcissists of the end time. Now, they have real power. I've explained several times that the entire prophecy of 2 Timothy 3, I mean, years ago, I mean, I remember hearing this explained when I first came into the church, there would be this universal application that this applies to everybody in society. And yeah, there's a hint of that. I mean, we all absorb a little bit of this, right? The whole world does kind of absorb a little bit, but the most applicable thing is that it's, even though some aspects of this are universal, it's a lot more specific than that. And I'll explain that in just a second. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, we say, it reads, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves." That's narcissistic. It also goes on to say, we'll not concentrate on this part, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful and unholy. Well, get used to it. We're going to come back to this verse a lot today. Deep dive into it. Proverbs 21 and verse 4 says, "A haughty look, a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked are sin." Whoa, wait a minute. Haughty look, a proud heart, we can probably identify people that are like that. You can identify leaders that are like that. But What is Solomon saying? The plowing of the wicked. The plowing of the wicked is a long-term commitment. Just like there has to be a lot of planning and intent when a farmer plows his crops. You know, let's just say you, for winter wheat, you plow in the fall after the harvest has come. You plant your seed, and then it begins to come up through the snow in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest, and then finally it's ready the next summer. That's a long time. So the plowing phase and the planting phase and everything takes a lot of work and preparation and planning. Well, God says that's the way it is with the wicked and the evil. The plowing or the long-term intention and planning shows the corruption at the highest levels of this world. So he's not just speaking about the average guy on the corner of the street. You know, if you're in Philadelphia, they're singing outside. And, you know, if you followed the Rocky movies, they're singing outside with a fire in a barrel. Not that average guy. Yeah, he may be in love with himself. He may be narcissistic, but who cares? Who's he going to influence? What change is he going to make in the world? How it's done, the plowing, the intent, how it's done does matter. Details matter. Otherwise, you're not going to see what you ought to see. The details of the intent of the plowing of the wicked are important. And I don't think we're all going to understand every aspect of them, but it's not just good enough to be like Flip Wilson and say, the devil made me do it. Well, what exactly did he do, make you do? What did they do? What do they do in this world? There's a lot of organization. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of preparation behind it. So how could this not apply to the leaders of this evil age that we live in today? And I'm not saying every single leader, but those that have evil intent. And, I mean, you can go back a long ways in history and you can find the actions and the attitudes and the evil intent and the plowing of wicked people. And a lot of times you might find that there are people, oh, I didn't understand how evil and wicked and bad that was, and I didn't think that guy was. I'm just going to be real careful and not mention any names today. Okay? You fill in the blanks if you can. And if you can't, see me later. I'll help you. While it's true that anybody could become wicked and could be lovers of themselves, what sphere of influence or wickedness would they have or affect if it's just somebody of little consequence? That's why I really believe that this applies to the leadership primarily of the world in which we live. And I'm not saying every single leader, okay, just so we understand. The second point that Paul makes, and it's not the only one, okay, I'm giving 6, not 18, the rejection of authority and correction. The rejection of authority and correction. And the converse of these is exactly what we will be studying for the next year, and some of you have already started. Little chat groups and text groups of back and forth, which is unbelievable and outstanding and a great use of the technology that we have available. One of the most revealing signs of the last days is the rejection of instruction. Paul includes this. I'm going to get into this because I've said this so many times. I hope you don't get bored by it, but if you do, then at least understand this. It still amuses me. Disobedient to parents. Paul says, disobedient to parents, and it used to be explained as though, you know, it was the actions of smart aleck teenagers who didn't respect their parents, or the Gen X and Y and Z and millennial generations didn't respect me. or me not respecting my parents, my great generation, the greatest generation parents, sassing them back. Could that be a possible explanation? That be the could that hold the key to all of the world's problems? Smart aleck teenagers. Proverbs consistently teach that wisdom begins with a willingness to be taught, and that rejecting correction is a hallmark of foolishness. You've already seen that in several instances. Back to 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers. We'll key in on this. Disobedient to parents, and what does that mean? Unthankful and unholy. At first, the phrase sounds out of place with all this other horrendous stuff that is going on. Boasters, proud, traitors, and everything else. It seems as though I can't make the connection. But Paul isn't telling Timothy to be on the lookout for smart aleck teens, which a number of you were, by the way, you know, when you were growing up. The meaning here is far more expansive than that, or children, than that which is within a nuclear family. It's a representation of wisdom, law, and moral restraint. So the original Greek here is gunesin apatithis, and who knows if that's the correct pronunciation, but it doesn't matter, you're going to forget it anyway. But the meaning is this: willfully unpersuadable, rebellious, and rejecting authority. It's the same root that is used for rebellion against God, ordained authority, not childish immaturity. So it's really having nothing to do with being disobedient in the nuclear family to parents, although obviously that happens, right? He's not talking about kids misbehaving. He isn't condemning smart aleck kids. He's saying that those described in this chapter will reject all moral boundaries and restraint. The political phrase that best fits, that some believe in and they don't teach it necessarily, but you can see by their actions that this is the way they live: the end justifies the means. Right out of the Communist Manifesto. Lenin also said, "Show me the man, I'll show you the crime." That means that none of us are perfect. So in some systems, all you have to do is arrest somebody and look long enough and you'll find something that they're guilty of. And especially under repressive political regimes and problems. They actually tried to do that in the later teens in this nation. They tried as hard as they could to find dirt on a person of prominence. They looked hard and they investigated and they looked and looked and looked and looked and spent millions and perhaps billions of dollars to try to find something so irreparably wrong that that person's life could be destroyed. And a lot of it was. But they came up with nothing. Being very careful today. Very careful. Rejecting parents, Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8 says, "My son, hear the instruction of your father and do not forsake the law of your mother." Rejecting parents means rejecting moral instruction, correction, and restraint. So what this is in this passage and also in Paul's advice to Timothy, it's prophetic shorthand for those in society who've rejected the norms of right and wrong. And Paul further explains that this is a dangerous trait, and as it says in verse 13, it's most concentrated in those who have the greatest authority in our society. So rather than it being out of place and being odd, it's foundational. It's not talking about what happens with a child and his parents. Although, of course, we have a commandment, right, to cover that. You should love your parents. You should respect your parents. Even sometimes parents don't do all the best things. You should love and respect your parents and obey them in God as much as you possibly can. That is a law. That's ironclad. It's not talking about that law right now. It's talking about something that is taking place in greater society. And it also fits perfectly with another theme that I've covered over and over and over again, and I wanted to emphasize it at the end of this year. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2, because it fits in perfectly with all of this. Contrary to what some have thought, this is sparkling water. Tastes like Alka-Seltzer. At some point in time, somebody came up with the idea after tasting Alka-Seltzer. You know, I love that so much. What if we just had a bottled water and we could make a mint selling this stuff that tastes like Alka-Seltzer? Anyway, guess I like the taste of Alka-Seltzer. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. That is the devil. That is Satan. That is the devil himself. Mr. Armstrong was so totally right. Broadcast in attitudes throughout the world, because he's the god of this world, broadcasting in these evil, wretched influences that persuade men. And Paul says that everybody has been affected by this broadcast, and that's true. But the point I'm making and have made is that the greatest concentration of this broadcast is found at the end of the verse. The Spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. So Paul was speaking about a spirit, and that spirit would be amplified among the leadership of the Roman Empire, and eventually all who became part of the Church of God would be terrorized by this power that was there. In Ephesus, it's very obvious when you read through the chapter, 16, 17, where it speaks about Paul being in Ephesus and calling out these people that were making idols of Diana, and then the whole town got into an uproar and everybody is angry and wants to kill all the people that are saying, you know, you shouldn't be selling idols. It gets that serious. Really. The Spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience ties in perfectly with the unloving and the ungodly and the unholy and the traitorous people that Paul mentions. And it's happening in our society today. And if you can't see it, you need to see it. And if you can't identify it, you need to identify it. I'm sorry for being so passionate about this, but you have to know the details. You have to understand. Because if you can't understand it, how are you going to watch and pray? Just kind of a generic prayer of, God help us to watch? I mean, years ago, I'll remember that, for those of you that may have read Gene Haugberg's work, he would write a weekly column in which he would give a world news report. It was very, very well done. He would talk about the nations in the world, what's happening in the nations of the world, and prophetically what was happening in the world at that time. And it was very good. And we didn't shy away from it. We can't shy away from it now. You know, I mean, had friends who have told me, Steve, we've been talking about that for 50 years. I said, no, we haven't. We've been talking about it for 80 years. It's more relevant now than it ever has been. If that spirit was working 2,000 years ago in the change agents of the Roman Empire, in the sons of disobedience at that time, people who had no knowledge of God, people who worship pagan gods, the spirit of disobedience working in those people and causing them to oppress the true church of God as it is done throughout history. As you read through the story of the true church, of the people of God, the people that kept the holy days and the Sabbath, the people that rejected the customs of this world and so on and so forth, before even the customs of this world became kind of, you know, encased in stone as it is today. If that spirit was working then in the sons of disobedience, that is the people who didn't know God, didn't care about God, weren't about to obey the Ten Commandments, then how much more is it working in the evil men of this age who have totally thrown off the restraint of God's law? It's much worse. It's much worse. We just haven't necessarily come into contact with it in a personal way ourselves, and I'll explain that at the end. In Proverbs 15 and verse 5, it says, "A fool despises his father's instruction, but he who receives correction is prudent." We receive correction. You receive correction. That's prudent. That's great. But the foolish are not just kind of dummies and foolish nitwits. It's talking about people who have cast off restraint, to people who revere the end justifies the end justifies the means more than the Ten Commandments. The third aspect that we'll cover today that Paul mentions is kind of a twisting, a moral inversion. You know, if this is right and this is wrong in this age, twist it upside down. Wrong is on top and right is at the bottom. Right? Does that make sense? The moral inversion, the justification of the wicked. Okay, now we're coming to the challenge question. The challenge question, I guess maybe that was several weeks ago, that was kind of the brainstorm or the beginning of this particular message. Among the most striking parallels between Paul and Proverbs is the theme of moral inversion. That is, where society excuses evil while condemning righteousness. The excuse of evil and the condemnation of righteousness. This is where several identified Proverbs 17 and verse 15, we'll get to that in a second, and Proverbs 18:5 as the answer to the wisdom challenge question. And that's the clearest match to Paul's, well, in my view, I mean, the others are as well, Paul's warning to Timothy. Let's go back to 2 Timothy chapter 3, 2 Timothy 3, verses 3 and 4, where Paul describes those individuals of this world that are leading it as unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good. That's where my emphasis is, the despisers of good. Traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And in Proverbs 17 and verse 15, as a reminder, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike, are an abomination to the Lord. That's my bell for acknowledging those who had the right answer. Or the answer that I had. You agreed with me, then you had the right answer. Proverbs 18 and verse 5, it is not good to show partiality to the wicked or to overthrow the righteous in judgment. And what has happened prominently in our Western world today? And it totally matches with Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Therefore, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. And we are at the tipping point now in our world, our Western world, in my opinion, at this very moment. We've used this verse almost exclusively in the past to help explain the aberrant behavior of murderers, rapists, bank robbers, and thieves, and that's certainly for sure true. I mean, since 2020, they estimated that about 25 million illegal aliens have been allowed into the United States of America, and the same thing is happening in all of the English-speaking nations of the world. Happening all of them, and some in much worse by proportion than here, strangely enough. But let's focus on the United States of America, because that's where we are living in. How often in the news Have you heard, and I mean, we're talking about legacy news, major news corporations who don't always report every single thing and all of the problematic things that are happening, but even at that, how many dozens of things have you heard where people who, whether they're illegal or not, I mean, it makes no matter, but mostly, a lot of times, people who have entered the country illegally, which is the foundational, if you're breaking the first law of coming into our country, then chances are you're not going to be too great about obeying all the rest, although maybe there's exceptions to all of that. But how many rapes and murders have been committed by the thieves and the muggers and the rapists from other countries admitted kind of on a wholesale basis? I mean, the news is filled with those. But it even gets worse. Because that kind of behavior is kind of expected from the thieves and the imprisoned and those that have been let out of prison from other countries. Just, go to make your way to the U.S. It's open now. But what about those who are leaders when justice is not executed upon them who are, people could say it's white-collar crime. It's not white-collar crime. It's black-collar crime. It's horrible. It's done by the people who are entrusted to regulate society, and they are the ones, in many cases, that are the worst offenders of all. And we are at a tipping point for that now, where people are wondering, well, is that going to be political retribution if that person is thrown in jail or that? Well, we probably years ago would not have used this to describe the influencers and the captains of industry, prominent politicians and scientists and bureaucrats. Because of bureaucrats, we might have claimed in the past they were just incompetent or redundant in their work or doing useless work. Not a great crime there necessarily. But that's where we're finding much of the crime today. Fill in the blanks for yourself. The fourth point, the breakdown of loyalty, trust, and law. The breakdown of loyalty, trust, and law. Paul describes a world where faithfulness collapses, where relationships are often disposable and truth is negotiable, and very rarely is there loyalty. Proverbs also warns us that when trust disappears, a society becomes unstable and dangerous. So the fourth point, the breakdown of loyalty, trust, and law. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 3 through 4 again. Unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And you find this echoed in both the minor and the major prophets of the prophecies that are extended to Joseph, Jacob, Israel, Ephraim, Manasseh, they're used interchangeably very often. Jacob's name was changed to Israel when he wrestled with God. God named him Israel, or overcomer with God. In Genesis 48, he puts his hands on Joseph's sons, the next to the last son, and he says, "Let my name be named upon them." And then in Genesis 49, there's a double blessing poured out on the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. So when you read Bible prophecy and you're reading Israel, most often it's both of those two individuals. It's the sons of Jacob, it's Ephraim and Manasseh. When you boil it all down, it's the English-speaking peoples of the world. You're welcome. I'm sorry. I make no excuse for God's promises to Abraham. Abraham obeyed God. Those blessings were passed on to his son Isaac and then passed on to his son Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, and all the other sons are mentioned in Genesis 49 as to what would befall them in the last days. And we are the inheritors of those promises. Ephraim and Manasseh, that's who Israel is. The sons of Jacob, the sons of Joseph. But we're living in a world where that loyalty and trust and law is broken down. Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 19 says, confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble is like a bad tooth and a foot out of joint. So unfaithfulness is a hallmark of the leadership. People that can't be relied upon. And I'm not saying everyone. There are people that try. Yeah, you can find them. You can find people that really try. But that's why I said several weeks ago that prophecy has a conditional side and an unconditional side. The unconditional side is that there's no going back from some of this. I mean, we could hope and we could pray for leaders and do all the things that Romans 13 says and be obedient where we can, as Titus says, and 2 Peter, you know, to the rulers of this world. But we have to identify them as well when they are evil and wicked and malicious. And you've got to be able to see that for what it is. As a Christian, you should. You shouldn't misidentify either. Wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove, right? The fifth aspect of this unrighteous leadership that is identified by Paul is brutality without conscience. And there are so many examples of this that I could get in real trouble if I just mention them all to you right now. They're right on the tip of my tongue, and I am so tempted. But sometimes they come from the most unsuspecting of individuals. Maybe some people might be thinking of a diminutive scientist who's responsible for torturing animals in another country in a study funded by the government. Made me sick when I learned about it. Made me horrified to read about it. It's just somebody said was the highest paid government employee in the history of the United States. Mr. Science. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal. You see the mind of individuals who are absolutely brutish in their opposition to others. It's satanic, is what it is. Proverbs speaks about this as well. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 10. A righteous man, think about this. There's a lot of truth to this, really simple. A righteous man regards the life of his animal. But the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. Now, somebody that would be maliciously vindictive to an animal or a pet or something that posed no harm, how could you ever look at that person in the same way? Totally demonic. Torturing of animals. And if you think that they wouldn't torture people in the same way, you're wrong. And we haven't even touched the surface of evil in our society. And there's so much more. This is a primer, but you know, I can't really go much further than this from the pulpit. I mean, it gets sickening to really contemplate the evil and the nature. Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 16. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans. That's the plowing of the wicked there. Feet that are swift in running to evil. This describes every aspect of our society today. A false witness who speaks lies and one who sows discord among the brethren. They're all awful. They're all horrible. The last of six, and that is why evil accelerates. It's because of delayed judgment. Why evil accelerates. It's something we're just going to have to get used to because I know that we'd all like to see justice prevail, but Solomon explains the mechanism behind the prophecy of Paul. When justice is delayed or ignored, people interpret silence as approval, and evil becomes more emboldened. That is the challenge hint that I gave Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. That is what people are clamoring for now. They're clamoring for, okay, we can see now what happened in our society, we can see why it happened. You got to hold those people accountable. If you don't hold them accountable, then it's just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And so that's why I say we're at kind of the apex. We're at the tipping point as to whether or not that might happen or it could happen. But I will say this, that no matter if it does or it doesn't, if it does, let's look on the bright side and hope that justice prevails in some way. It won't be long-lasting. It won't be long-lasting. It can't be, because there are unconditional prophecies that will be fulfilled. And God knows the end from the beginning, so man is going to go in this direction. And even though you can have the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike for a little while, after a while he gives out. He's too little. He can't stop the torrent and the flood of evil that is going to happen. Proverbs 28 and verse 4. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them. Yeah, sometimes there's contention of good people that contend against evil people. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 13, evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. I know it's repetitive. I want the point to get home. I want the point to be understood. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 14, there is a vanity which occurs on earth. That there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. You know, this goes all the way back 3,000 years to Solomon's time and to the Garden of Eden, actually. That there are things that happen to just people, like people being thrown into jail for taking a walk for years, for grandmothers being put in jail because they disagree with their government, for people being, the list is so endless. You can't ignore that. You can't say, okay, well, this just happens. I mean, no. It's a fulfillment of prophecy. And Solomon went on to say, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. They get away with it. David spoke about this in the Psalms. He said, I pondered this, and he said, I was troubled. You know, I couldn't understand how the wicked could get away with it until I stepped into the house of the Lord. Until I came to church, you might say. Didn't understand how it could happen. So Solomon is saying something we all know. Our world gets it wrong and backwards oftentimes. A moral inversion, as one of the previous points was, and even more so now 3,000 years later. So I'm going to close today with some end time warnings for God's people. We finished the 6 points. End time warnings for God's people. I'm going to warn you of prophecy fatigue, a terminology that I mentioned several times. I mentioned it earlier today. This is a real danger, and it explains the need for the prophecy of 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. I believe that Peter was inspired by what Paul had written, and those letters were circulating. And the Holy Spirit inspired him as well to write this to reinforce what Paul had already written down in his parchments. Beloved, I now write to you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets. You know, go back and read Hosea and Micah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah, and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, carried equal weight. The Holy Spirit inspired Paul or Peter to write that this work that he was writing carried equal weight as what they had said previously thousands of years earlier. knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, by the world which then existed perished, being flooded with water. The certainty of destruction and universal destruction is there, Paul said, when sin is expansive to the point that it will be at the time of the end. And he's speaking of that time right here in 2 Peter, and he is speaking about prophetic fatigue. Oh, we've been speaking about that for 50 years. No, it's 80, by the way. And it's more relevant now than ever. You can't be an ostrich. You've got to wake up. And the second thing, besides prophetic fatigue, that I'm going to mention, this may hit hard, okay? But it's the blessings / generational bias. I come up with these terms myself. The blessings / generational bias. What do I mean by that? Well, let's put it this way. If you're old enough to be my kids, my younger cousins, my nieces, my nephews, my grandchildren, that would include every generation, I think, besides the boomer generation, which I've already said is the greatest of all generations. I've told you that. You know that. That was a joke, by the way, mostly. For those of us in older generations, well, let me back up. This applies to all of us. This blessing / generational bias. For most people in my audience today and watching on the internet, the most dramatic thing that has ever happened in their lives is 9/11 and COVID. Okay, for a lot of people, for people that are my age and older, we remember the Depression and World War II. Not that we went through it ourselves, but we heard about it so much from our parents. We felt like we had gone through the Great Depression. Every mealtime, eat that. We would have given our right arm to have that piece of broccoli back in 1937. Turn off that light. Do you think we own the electric company? If you grew up in the 50s or the 60s, you were reminded of want and need and having to work three jobs to make ends meet during the Great Depression, or then the horrors of war if your parents had gone to war. Man, I mean, as a kid, I'm 11 years old, I felt like I'd gone through the Great Depression. So that's a little lightness and levity before we finish up today. But seriously, the greater parts of our generations alive today have grown up knowing a lot of prosperity. A lot of prosperity. We have the blessings of Abraham that are still here, by the way. They're not removed yet by God. But you see, because of that, that can obscure the reality of prophecy unfolding. Hosea chapter 13 and verse 6 says, when they had pasture, they were filled. They were filled and their heart was exalted, therefore they forgot me. It's where prophecy fatigue, blessings, and generational bias can come into play. And that's the reason for prophecies like 2 Peter 3 and a lot of other prophecies as well in the New Testament. A lot of reasons for the warnings at the end of Revelation 3. I won't go into that today. But it shows that there are some people who just are deniers of what's happening in the world around them. And that's where I believe details can matter. How and why something happens is important to me, because we're told to watch and pray. And I know the most of that in Luke 21, 32, Luke. Anyway, it's there, watch and pray always. I know that's watching your own spiritual condition. But we also have to be observant of what is happening in the world and why it's happening. And Paul helps us to explain, and Proverbs helps us to understand as well. It just never gets old. Wisdom is one of the strategies of God's people in dealing with Bible prophecy. And Paul's warning is sobering, but it's not hopeless. God has always preserved his people through wisdom, and that's the reason generally for the Wisdom 2026 challenge. When evil men grow worse, those who fear God grow stronger in discernment. We've had a lot of messages on becoming wise and understanding the difference between naivete and wisdom. So as we approach 2026, the wisdom challenge is, in my view, it's not optional. It's essential. How you get there, it may be up to you. Take another path than what I've presented. Go your own path, but develop wisdom through the Bible. The world may reward evil, and it's going to as time goes on. But God still honors wisdom, and he always will.